Okay, great. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Well, good morning and thank you all for coming. It's gratifying to see so many people after these 2 years of drought. And as we start to open up slowly, it'd be nice to see you all come again. And I'd like to thank Rev. Master Mayon for inviting me to say a few words. There she is. Thank you. Today we celebrate the life of the Buddha in its entirety, the birth, his life of teaching, and his death. With a certain emphasis on the birth of the Buddha, because of the ceremony that we do, when you read what we sang today or read stories of the Buddha's birth, the accounts usually contain some supernatural or miraculous aspects. Trees consciously bending down, the Buddha taking 7 steps and lotus blossoms appear where he stepped. His being born from the right side of his mother, or him stating, "I am alone, I am the world-honored one," or something to that effect. And one sometimes asks, is the truth of Buddhism dependent on those aspects of the story of Buddhism being true? And I must say that I wasn't there, so I cannot speak with absolute certainty as to what happened. But my guess is that much of which is written down now was a result of generations of the story of his birth being transmitted orally. And, of course, a story is easier to remember if it's interesting. As opposed to, the Buddha was born in a field. So I think some of what we have are embellishments to make the story more rememberable. And I also think there's symbolism in there. 7 is often a number associated with stages of spiritual progress in religion. Him being said to have said, "I alone am the world-honored one." To me, that addition, again, could be something that was added for reasons that might be somewhat obscure now, but it reminds me of human nature and almost a skillful means we use on ourselves to value what we do highly as the best. You seldom hear people saying, "Well, my religion is second best." And I can understand the value of that, just so that we can just get on with our practice and not worry about comparing or wondering, you know, is something else better. So as a skillful means and as a way to transmit a story that inspires confidence and faith in those who hear it, that makes sense to me, and it makes sense that we as human beings tend to value what we do in that way, but hopefully it doesn't go beyond that skillful means. It doesn't go into talking down or denigrating what others do as lesser. When I became a monk some 50 years ago, and that surprises me to hear that coming out of my mouth. I was fairly naive. I became more of a disciple rather than becoming a monk. And I didn't ask, well, what does this mean? What does that mean? And I need to know what all these things mean. I just kind of bowed and, you know, that's what you do. So I did that. So I can't tell you the meaning of the many things that we have in our practice, but I found a way to find a meaning for myself, as if I didn't, you know, inquire about a meaning or wasn't told about a meaning. To me, the Buddha on the altar, an aspect of that, has always symbolized the Buddha within me, the Buddha within all of us. So in pouring water over the baby Buddha, one way to look at that is water symbolizing cleansing, compassion, pouring water over ourselves, reminding ourselves of the need to be compassionate to ourselves, not judgmental to ourselves, give ourselves a break. So feel free to, if you're wondering about the meaning of something, you can ask about it or find meaning of it for yourself. What do we actually know factually about the Buddha's life? Buddhism wasn't written down for several generations, if not hundreds of years, till after its death. It was transmitted orally. We can assume he existed, and if he did, he was born, and we can assume he taught, and we can assume he died. But the exact facts around all this, again, the value, the truth of Buddhism is not dependent on the absolute truth of the story. The truth of Buddhism is proved by doing the practice. So in terms of what words the Buddha himself actually spoke, well, it wasn't English for one thing, so there's the translation matter involved between now and then, but there is the oral translation, the transmission of what people have heard, and I don't want to underestimate the accuracy which can be maintained if someone's practice is to hear something orally and pass it on. And at the same time, I know how things can change quickly. I know I've given a talk, and 5 minutes later someone will say, I really like what you said about such and such, and that's news to me. So I think especially the early scriptures basically got it right, but in terms of pinning so much on the absolute accuracy and meaning of every word, I don't think we need to do that. Again, the truth of Buddhism doesn't depend on that. It depends on the validity of the practice if you do it. So what do you have to believe in? I think a bottom line thing is that you have to believe you can change. I think most of us have come to practice Buddhism because of the wish for some sort of change. If we were completely content, we'd just be at home watching telly or whatever. But usually there's something we want to add to what we've got, something that inspires us that we think we don't have, or something we'd like to fall away, some aspect of suffering that is hard to endure, and we want that to become less. So it's necessary to believe you can change. But you also have to be willing to look at yourself and do whatever work that requires. And Buddhism offers a way to do that work. It's not the only way to do that work. It's just a particular way to do that work. And it's a way that directs us in a direction of suffering less, finding pleasure, joy, happiness in life, and suffering less. And this suffering can exist on a variety of levels. It can exist on the physical level, pain, learning how to pay attention, you know, so that when you're driving you don't get in an accident and suffer pain. That's perhaps the coarsest type of suffering is physical pain. But obviously there's emotional pain, psychological pain, and there's the existential pain of just plain having a self that seems very perishable, very isolated. The anxieties and fears that can come upon one when death is at hand. And Buddhism does offer ways to come to terms with all these aspects of suffering. But again, it requires doing the work to walk that path, and not just believe that it can happen. I look at the story of the Buddha's life as a template for the average person's life, for human life as it is, as a universal quality. The story says he was protected from seeing suffering in his palaces. Don't we do that with our children? Don't we try to prevent them from suffering? Try to minimize it? Protect them from physical harm or disturbing events that might scar them emotionally? Don't we protect ourselves from whatever is disturbing to us, whether it's trying to avoid confrontation or, you know, we've all got our list of things that we try to avoid. So his being protected from suffering is what we do to ourselves, to our own children. We try to minimize our suffering and turn towards that which is enjoyable or pleasurable. And that's baked into us biologically, which ultimately is good. It's an artifact of evolution, of our animal level. But unfortunately, some of that baked in stuff still is with us, you know, the propensity for anger, the propensity for judging others as different as us than oneself. But now we have the human intelligence to look at that part of ourselves and say, no, there was a reason, perhaps on the animal level, for us to behave in certain ways. But we don't have to now. We can see the merit of not doing that. But we have to make that choice and just not say, well, because I feel a certain way, that's the truth. The Buddha, according to the story, saw the four sights: birth, old age, disease, death, and wandering mendicant, which summarized the four sights. Which, according to the story, shook his world, got him thinking. And it's not uncommon for us to encounter those sorts of times in life which get our attention. Someone drops that in front of you. Or you get a glimpse of something more inherent in life, and you want to pursue that, you want to know more about it. It causes you sometimes the question of the meaning of your life. How's it been going? You know, what time do you have left? What are you going to do with it? So, just as the Buddha's status quo was shaken, you know, by what he saw in the story, so that can happen to us, and probably happens to most people to one degree or another. To some extent, I think it's happening now on a global basis. You know, usually our sense of impermanence is personal, but it almost seems to be more on a global level now with what's going on, with war, with Africa being on the precipice of famine, which you don't really read about in the news. It's not page two kind of news, or below the fold, as they say, but it's mind-bogglingly, you know, tragic. And life is repeatedly showing us, if we have the eyes to see, the reality of impermanence and the need to really look at our lives. What are we doing with it? When I drive from, when I'm visiting temples, I, as most people do, often will see an animal that's been killed on the side of the road. And I might just be still, I might say the three homages. But if I really think about it, and not kind of say, okay, you know, it's just an animal, you know, or a fly, you know, you see a fly or an ant and you just sort of, you know, it doesn't really rise as something you really give a lot of thought about. When I'm driving along and I think about that animal, that bang, just like that, you know, its life force was snuffed out. And I think nature doesn't offer me any special dispensation from that. Just because I'm a human being, I'm as vulnerable as that animal was, and it makes me think. I try to use those times to kind of pull myself back into myself, and if nothing more, pay attention to driving, because there could be the bang, you know, for me at any minute if I lose my attention. Because I don't know when I will live my last day. None of us does. If I were to say, who's next? Someone, one of you should be holding your hand up. And I notice as I get older, kind of the backdrop of things that I do in life is just different. Practical level, I can be looking for, well, I need some online storage. If I were 20, it would be, well, 10 years of online storage for a one-time price of $100. Or you can pay $20 a year, you know, and, oh, 5 years, well, I'll break even. That's good, because I'm 20 and the future's kind of wide open. Now I'm 71 and I kind of have to do the calculations, you know. How long am I going to be, how much do I want to buy ahead of time? So that whole backdrop, the whole mindset kind of gets influenced by how far along you think you are. Our Master G used to say, there are a lot of graves in the graveyard shorter than me. So what do I know? This could be my last talk. And when I realized that could be true, I started playing with the idea. Okay, what if this were my last talk? What if it's my last chance to pass on anything I thought would be worth passing on, some aspect of the Dharma or words of encouragement? If I were falling out of a building, I might say, carry on, friends, you know, and that would be it. You know, don't doubt you can prove the Dharma true for yourself if you practice, but I've got a little more time than that. And I don't know if I took the time to say anything I would wish to. I don't know what that would be. Certainly more time than it would be longer than what we have now. But it would probably contain something along the lines of the following. I remember a few years ago listening to a late night talk show, which is usually about nothing particularly weighty. I don't know what the subject was at the time. It's probably KGO, which I liked it better in the past than what it's devolved to now. But in any case, there was someone who called up and said he'd been reduced to living in a cardboard box. He'd lost everything. He was at the bottom end of the bottom end. And he said something happened to him that he wanted to share over the radio. And he said he saw, and these are my words because I can't remember exactly, he saw the glory and miraculousness of ordinary human consciousness. And it was clear he had gone through some transformation. His was not an intellectual conclusion, but a direct experience of something about his essential nature. Circumstances had taken everything away from him. He had nothing left, but somehow he found a way to look up rather than down, a way to carry on. He had nothing, and in that emptiness, something had the opportunity to shine through. Soto Zen is sometimes called the comfortable way. I think generally that means we don't engage in difficult ascetic practices. Simply, you know, we simply sit in meditation. For a Westerner who wasn't raised, simply sitting cross-legged in meditation, I wouldn't call it comfortable in that sense to me. But what I take from it is that unlike the man in the cardboard box who had everything taken away from him, our way is to let things go one at a time as they arise, rather than suffer the trauma of life stripping us bare. And by letting go, I don't mean cutting off or devaluing things. I mean not clinging to things in a way that denies their reality, the fact that all things change. And doing so allows us to be more at ease with the relationships we have, not only with people, but the things of our lives. The letting go is not grasping onto something, but letting it, more like letting it fall from your hand. It's still there, but you can pick it up as needed. It's not a rejection or a cutting off. Getting back to the man in the cardboard box, if he were a good communicator, had maybe a little charisma and could share what he found in a way that answered a need within his culture at the time, he might have started a religion. I'm sure there are many people out there who have had such deep insights into their lives, but it doesn't go much further than themselves. If the man in the box did get the attention of others who thought, I want what he has, they might look at the externals of what he did and think, I'll get my own cardboard box and do what he did. But of course, his transformation had little to do with the cardboard box, if anything, but had something to do with the process that was going on inside him. This reminds me of the story of the monk who said he was sitting on Zazen to become a buddhak, and the master started polishing a tile next to him to make a mirror. And the disciple said, you can't polish a tile to make a mirror. And the master said, just sitting cross-legged won't make you a Buddha. Unless, of course, you're doing the inner process at the same time, which, strictly speaking, is independent of sitting or any outward form. If the man in the box understood his own inner process, he might try to communicate that. But knowing, however, that having a complete understanding of whatever process or steps he laid out was not it. The understanding of doctrine is not the same as understanding one gets by actually practicing the teaching. But you have to start somewhere. You would have to start somewhere. One starts with the known, which points and leads to the as yet unknown. And herein lies a shortcoming of most of us, that being the tendency for our intellect to focus on what it understands and just put aside what it can't get a hold of. Our intellect attaches and identifies to what it understands, what the I in us understands. Now, this is not to say that there is no benefit to the intellect, for of course there is. It's because of our intellect that we can realize the consequences of our behavior and that of others in terms of what causes suffering for ourselves and others. We aren't just at the mercy of our animal instincts. We can distinguish between right and wrong, choose compassion over cruelty, etc. We can choose good over evil, and by evil here I mean those thoughts, words, or deeds that cause suffering and reinforces profound separation between self and other. We can choose love over hatred, light over darkness. When I became a monk, Buddhism was not in the culture as much as it is now. You tended to hear about it, at least I did, if someone in your circle of friends told you about something. I can remember a few books that were out, Three Pillars of Zen, the Teachings of the Compassionate Buddha. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind was out, but just around that time I hadn't read that. I don't think I had read that. Of course, there was the works of Alan Watts, which was very popular, but I just hadn't read much of that. Nowadays, it's a very different scene. There wasn't the internet then. Now, you can spend day in and day out, probably for the rest of your life, and continue to find new words, you know, new expressions of Buddhism. There are innumerable YouTube talks and books which point out the importance of cultivating the virtues of compassion, love, and wisdom. Point out the importance of aspiring to the good and the transforming of our selfishness and harmful behavior. As important as morality is, it's not a final resting place, as far as Buddhism is concerned. Doing good is not a bench at the end of the road on which to sit. Although I suppose it depends on to what you aspire, and by that I don't mean to judge what anyone aspires to. I'm just saying there is something beyond both good and evil, something beyond the opposites of good and evil. And to encounter that requires not getting stuck with or resting in the good, resting in love or light, not letting them become a subtle anchor for the self. As kids, we used to do an experiment where you'd hang a thread in sugar water, and you'd come back some days later, and there'd be all these crystals that had attached themselves to the thread. And the doing of good should not be as if a thread to which the self gets attached and becomes hard and set and becomes associated with judging others. This doesn't mean you don't do the right thing. You don't forget about being compassionate and kind. You do, but it's something you let go of and you move through as you do it. There is something beyond separate selves helping other separate selves, which of course has merit, but there is a bigger picture. Buddhism offers a more profound understanding of what is. Now, we can all appreciate the value of not acting from a selfish point of view. The problem is actually doing so when our conditioning or instincts are acting upon us. It's not always easy to restrain ourselves in thought, word, and deed, even when we know it's the right thing to do. And the problem with doing good is that we don't appreciate that it too has some hooks if we fail to realize that we have to walk past it as well. Again, the string in the sugar water. We walk past it as we do it. And as to what lies on the path beyond the opposites of good and evil, that's something we have to find out for ourselves directly. So I won't give you any definition to hold on to. But I will say to encounter it sheds light on how influential the working of your mind is in creating the meaning and reality, the meaning of the reality in which you find yourself. And you also see you have much more say-so about how your mind works and the reality it creates. You realize you have much more say-so than you had appreciated before. You know more how to let go of the stuff of the mind. And you also have an appreciation of how to let go of the mind itself. Reverend Master Jiyu's university, Durham University, had a motto: that which is true is greater than that which is holy. But I might ask, what is greater than that which is true? Regarding this aspect of keeping going, I found a section recently in a biography of a Thai nun named Meiji Kao. Apologies if I've not pronounced that correctly. A modern day Buddhist nun considered a modern day arhat. She died in 1971. And I found a passage that I found very much to the point. It resonates with our teaching of letting go and having no resting place. And I'll quote it, not exactly. The vocabulary is a little different, and her practice may emphasize different aspects of the overall practice, but it does help me make a point. And she wrote, or her biographer wrote, "When the offshoots of delusion were completely cut, her mind converged into a nucleus of sublime radiance, a radiance so majestic and mesmerizing that she felt certain it signaled the end of all the suffering that she had been striving to attain. Having relinquished all attachment to the factors of personal identity, the subtle radiant splendor at the center of the mind became her sole remaining focus." Kind of sounds pretty good. And she decided to speak with her teacher and offer what she had found. And she did speak with him. She spoke of her progress over the past year, carefully detailing the consecutive stages of her experience, and concluded with her lion's roar, the radiant emptiness of mind that permeated the entire cosmos and transcended all conditions. When she stopped speaking, her teacher looked up and calmly asked, "Is that it? Is that all?" She nodded. Her teacher paused for a moment and then spoke. "When you investigate mental phenomena until you go completely beyond them, the remaining elements of consciousness may be drawn into a radiant nucleus of awareness, which merges with the mind's natural radiant essence. This radiance is so majestic and mesmerizing that even transcendent faculties like spontaneous mindfulness and intuitive wisdom invariably fall under its spell. The mind's brightness and clarity appear to be so extraordinary and awe-inspiring that nothing can possibly compare. The luminous essence is the epitome of perfect goodness and virtue, the ultimate in spiritual happiness. It is the core of your being, but it is also the fundamental source of all attachment to being and becoming. Ultimately, it is attachment to the allure of this primordial radiance of mind that causes living beings to wander indefinitely through the world of becoming and ceasing. That center of knowing appears as a luminous emptiness that truly overwhelms and amazes. But that radiant emptiness should not be mistaken for the pure emptiness of nirvana. The two are as different as night and day. The radiant mind is the original mind of the cycle of constant becoming, but it is not the essence of mind which is free from birth and death. Such radiance is a very subtle natural condition whose uniform brightness and clarity make it appear empty. It is the very substance of mind that has been well cleansed to the point where as a mesmerizing and majestic quality of knowing is its outstanding feature. When the mind finally relinquishes all attachments to forms and concepts, the knowing essence assumes exceedingly refined qualities. It has let go of everything except itself. It remains permeated by a fundamental delusion about its own true nature. Because of that, the radiant essence has turned into a subtle form of self without you realizing it. You end up believing that the subtle feelings of happiness and the shining radiance are the unconditioned essence of mind. But emptiness, radiance, clarity, and happiness are all subtle conditions of a mind still bound by delusion. When you observe the emptiness carefully, you will observe that it is not really uniform, not really constant. Sometimes it changes, just a little, but enough for you to know that it is transient. Try imagining yourself standing in an empty room. You look around and see only empty space everywhere. Absolutely nothing occupies that space, except you standing in the middle of the room. Admiring its emptiness, you forget about yourself. Once the mind has let go of phenomena of every sort, the mind appears supremely empty. But the one who admires the emptiness, who is awestruck by the emptiness, that one still survives. The self as reference point, which is the essence of all fast knowing, false knowing, remains integrated into the mind's knowing essence. This self perspective is the primary delusion. You forget that you occupy a central position in that space. How then can the room be empty? As long as someone remains in the room, it is not truly empty. When you finally realize that the room can never be truly empty until you depart, that is the moment when that fundamental delusion about your true self disintegrates. So here we have the teacher pushing her beyond perceptions of emptiness, radiance, clarity, happiness, experiences of joy, pushing her beyond them, saying, keep going, don't stop there. He's not disparaging them. He's just saying there is more. Which reminds me of our maxim, our underlying maxim in Zazen, where we don't try to achieve any particular state, nor is there a state we rest in, however wonderful it may be. It reminds me of the phrase beginner's mind. Never losing beginner's mind. Similarly, the phrase, it is difficult to keep the humility to the end and not lose that beginner's mind. As I mentioned before, aspects of Buddhism, which aren't necessarily unique to Buddhism, such as different forms of meditation, have made their way into our culture much more than they have, or than they were, than they did exist previously. And I hope that Buddhism does not devolve into a therapeutic tool to improve the life of the self, but continues to lead one to a place of liberating insight into what the self actually is or isn't. Speaking as a monk, I hope the master-disciple relationship does not fall in disuse or fade from the scene because the mere appearance of hierarchy is deemed not politically correct. And I hope the master-disciple relationship, in its various forms, does not lose its efficacy because masters are afraid to be masters, lest they be accused of not being sensitive enough or nice enough to their disciples, or afraid to give hard teaching that challenges the disciples and students, especially at those critical make-or-break times in the disciples' or students' spiritual life. In other words, I hope Buddhism does not lose its edge as it grows in the West. I hope it continues to challenge us to be more than we appear to be. Religion can become like a golden cage, in which it's easy to see the gold, but hard to see that it's a cage. And yes, one may walk happily and freely within the cage, but still not know freedom in its deepest sense. So, I think I will end it here. And again, thank you all for coming. I believe we have ringing the great bell to follow.